Nashuku melea Nashuku kelugo melugo bulu samba
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. On today's show, we will start by listening to the author and scholar Dr. Ariella Azoulay. Dr. Azoulay argues in her new book that there is a need to decolonize the history of the Jewish people and end the myth of the Judeo-Christian tradition. She argues that the Western version of history has erased Jewish diverse histories and identities and allowed Zionism to hijack Jewish identity for Western interests. After, we will see the current situation in Gaza and how the start of winter is worsening even more the impacts of the ongoing genocide being committed against Palestinians by the Israeli government. Stay tuned.
And when they invented the Judeo-Christian world actually to absolve Europe from its crimes against Jews, they assigned to the Jews that were amalgamated an enemy: Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. Reformulating, and this is, I think, the contribution of my book, is to re-understanding what is our liberation project. And our liberation project is liberation from Europe, liberation from being colonized by Europe through the gift, this horrible gift with quotation mark, that was given to the Zionist, which is Palestine.
This is the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. We discuss all things related to Palestine and examine how they intersect with the political landscape here in Canada and beyond. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. In this episode of Palestine Debrief, I speak with Dr. Ariella Azoulay, a renowned scholar, filmmaker, and author whose work focuses on the intersections of colonialism, photography, and historical narratives. Ariella was born in Israel but rejects the Israeli identity, where she identifies as a Muslim Jew. She refers to Israel as the Zionist settler colony during this episode. In her latest book, The Jewelers of the Ummah, A Potential History of the Jewish Muslim World, published earlier this year, she examines the disruption of Jewish Muslim life in Algeria and in the Maghreb, North Africa, by two colonial projects, French rule and the Zionist colonization of Palestine. We spoke about the active movements and demonstrations by Jews against the genocide, such as the occupation of Union Station in New York, and more recently here in Canada, the bold action of Jews Against Genocide Coalition and their stage sit-in at the Confederation Building on Parliament Hill in Ottawa. The importance of this conversation with Dr. Ariella is to understand the historical and ideological underpinnings of how colonialism profoundly reshaped Jewish communities in North Africa and the Arab world, and integrating them into a Western construct. Dr. Ariella sheds light on how colonialism split people into nonsensical groups, creating divisions that erased shared histories and communities, and how, like colonialism, Zionism at its core perpetuates anti-Semitism by co-opting Jewish identity and erasing diverse Jewish histories and traditions. This conversation offers a compelling analysis on how these dynamics influence the struggle for justice today. Dr. Ariella, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. Happy to be here. It's a pleasure.
So I've read your book, and in the introduction, you discuss the erasure of Algerian Jewish history and how colonial powers, particularly in France, played a role in the migration of Algerian Jews to France and then to Israel. And you talked about the transformation of the term you used, Arab Jew, and you even in the introduction mentioned Muslim Jew, to French Jew and then to Israeli Jew. I think one of the things that jumped out as well was the building of the synagogues after the colonization. Suddenly, there were the Western buildings that were introduced into Algeria. What's the relationship between separating the Jews from the Muslim world? and particularly in North Africa and the colonized regions of North Africa and Israel?
Yeah, thank you for this question. There are some, you know, nuances that I would like to engage with before, you know, replying broadly to your question. So what I'm trying to do in the book is not to narrate the history of the Jews in Algeria, because I'm trying to resist this amalgamation of the Jews and their implied separation from other Algerians. So while there is literature about Jews in Algeria, what I'm trying to do is to understand how come that through two colonial projects, the Jews were amalgamated as one group, being identified in a European invention of the Jewish people with quotation mark that amalgamates Jews from all over the world, erases their diversity, their differences, and make out of the Jews one people with a destiny, and the destiny was invented by the West as having a state of their own, which means colonizing Palestine. So what I'm trying to do in the book is to depict, recover and inhabit the Jewish Muslim world in which my ancestors lived and in which Jews lived in Algeria without understanding themselves as one people. They were part of Algeria. They lived in communities, diverse communities throughout Algeria. You know, there were Jews who lived in Demzeb, which is in the Sahara. There were Jews who lived, you know, in big cities, in Oran, Wahran, in Alger, in other, you know, areas, more rural areas. And they were, you know, different communities, even though they shared the fact that they were Jews, which means that they had some commonalities. The book, first of all, is a refusal to accept that this destruction of the Jewish Muslim world is a fait accompli. And if I mentioned earlier the legacy of Palestinians that resisted from the very beginning when they were expelled from Palestine to accept this as a fact, what happened with the Jews is through several, you know, violent processes of colonization in Europe. They were colonized in Europe and they were colonized in North Africa and they were colonized by the Euro-Zionists. They actually were not able to continue to transmit a lot of what was destroyed by those colonial projects. So the book is a refusal to accept that even though my ancestors finally, at the end of the colonization of Algeria, found themselves outside of Algeria, doesn't mean that I cannot claim my belonging to Algeria and to the Jewish Muslim world and define myself as a Muslim Jew. And why a Muslim Jew? First of all, because, you know, there is this incredible work about, you know, Arab Jews. It is very important in different contexts, but in the context of the Maghreb, where you have Berber Jews and Arab Jews, to prioritize only Arab Jews seems to me to betray also the complexity of our identities as Berbers. So the choice of referring to myself as a Muslim Jew is because when I think about, you know, my ancestors in the broader sense, not only my direct ancestors, but, you know, who were the Jews who lived in Algeria, they shared with Muslims their traditions, because Muslims were Arab and Berbers, Jews were Arab and Berbers, and what they shared is liturgy. What they shared are many costumes. What they share is their food. What they share is their shared history prior to the colonization and from the colonization. And what the French did, not from the very beginning, but, you know, fairly after, they started to separate the communities. So they started to separate the Berbers, for example. But what does it mean to separate the Berbers when they also separate the Jews? Where do they place the Jews, the Berber Jews, among the Berbers or among the Jews? So, you know, the colonial taxonomy to separate people worked, you know, in Algeria on in high speed. And I'm trying to struggle against it, and I'm trying to reconstruct the commonalities between Jews and Muslims that enable them also to be separate communities. So I'm not trying to say that there were no differences between Jews and Muslims, but those differences is exactly what allowed them to live together, because since the inception of Islam, Jews were protected communities under the law of the Dhimma. So they were protected, you know, communities, and they were defined by their professions. Jews, for example, were the jewelers of the Ummah. the majority of jewelers in North Africa and in the Middle East were Jews. And this was because of certain division of labor between Jews and Muslims. But they were the majority of jewelers doesn't mean that they catered only their communities. And this is why I call the book The Jewelers of the Ummah, because they catered, you know, the entire society. So they were distinguished as under this profession, but they were included and part of the entire society. And this is what the colonization destroyed. And one last thing maybe about, you know, my study of the Jews in Algeria, my study of the Jewish Muslim world and the role of the Jews or the history of the Jews as part of this world, is that while the Zionist colonization in Palestine already provoked the forced migration of Jews from different other countries that became Muslim countries rather than Jewish Muslim worlds, the Zionists provoked this migration from Algeria. They were incapable to provoke a mass migration. The Jews in Algeria stayed until the end of the colonization, until 62. They refused to say yes to the Zionist project. They refused to many attempts by Zionists to infiltrate Algeria and to try to provoke, you know, violence, to show the Jews that they should not stay there because Muslims are very dangerous for them, etc. And the Jews persisted in their will to stay in Algeria. In 62, when the Jews finally had to leave Algeria because the Evian Accord, this Accord of Evian, actually sacrificed them. And they had to leave Algeria. Only 20% of the Algerian Jews left for the Zionist colony in Palestine. Most of them went either to France or to Montreal, to Canada, because these were the Francophone, you know, places where they could find themselves. And they didn't want to go to the Zionist colony in Palestine.
What were the Vienna Accords that you mentioned? How did that affect their migration?
So what is known as the Algerian War, you know, started in the 50s. Toward the end of the 50s, it was clear to the French that they can no longer hold Algeria. They can no longer colonize Algeria, that the colonization is arriving to its end. So what they try to do is to get as much as they can after they will had to leave Algeria. So during 2 years, they negotiated with Algerians that at the time, through the Evian Accord, became only Muslim Algerians. So the Accord Evian were actually between Algerians as Muslims and between French as Christian. And the Jews actually had no place in these negotiations. And this is why I use the term they were sacrificed. Because in those negotiations, it was clear that they can no longer stay there. And these negotiations that already by the format of the negotiations between, you know, Muslims and Christians, the Jews were left outside. And this is something that the French actually desired since the very beginning of the colonization, when they tried to stage the colonization as a civilizational struggle between Islam and Christianity, or between Europe and Islam. So what we saw in 62 is the departure of the Jews, not because Algerian expelled them, but because, you know, two colonial projects made it impossible for them to stay. And why do I say two colonial projects? Because the transformation of the Zionist colony in Palestine into a state actually made the life of Jews in the Jewish Muslim world very difficult, because the state, the Zionist state, tried to sabotage their life to make them believe that their only place, secure place is in Palestine. So they tried to hire some of them to become spies. They tried to bomb certain synagogues to make them feel unsafe. And they negotiated with certain leaders of those countries about their departure, like we saw in Morocco, the complicity actually of Morocco in the departure of the Jews. So it is not surprising for me that the Evian Accord actually not only sacrificed the departure of the Jews, but actually negotiated how France will continue, or how the colonial French state apparatuses will continue to be in place after the departure of the colonizers. And it is known, you know, the work of Sami Yaheni and others about nuclear tests in the Sahara after the departure of the French. range, and many others, you know, elements that the colonial state, you know, that testified that the colonial state persisted.
You know, a number of things you said that were interesting. My grandmother, who lived in Safad until 1948, of course, and moved to Lebanon, she passed away fairly recently. I think it was 10 years ago. I was still in my 30s then. I was aware of her. One of the things she used to tell me is that they would only buy their jewelry from Jews in Safad before 48. She said they were the most honest. She said you would go to Muslim or Christian jewelers and they would say, I swear to God, I swear to my mother, I swear to my father. But a Jew would never swear and always be truthful. She would always say that. The other thought that came to mind when you said about, you know, the Berber Jews and how the French started to, you know, split the communities. One of the things that came to mind is because my family are Palestinian Lebanese. We migrated to Lebanon and that's where my parents currently live with my brothers as well. And I think that was something very similar they did as well with the Muslim and Christian and Druze communities in Lebanon. And I think to a very big degree, they succeeded because now Lebanon, there is a national identity of Lebanese Christians that's vastly different than the identity of Muslims. And it, from the outside looking in, it doesn't make sense. It's the same food, it's the same language, it's the same culture, it's the same, like, it is the same. But inherently, within Lebanese societies, there is a clear distinguishing between Lebanese Christians and Lebanese Muslims. To an extent, I think that even Lebanese Christians identify that ethnically they aren't Arabs, they are Phoenicians. There was that extension. And I found that a very interesting parallel between the French colonization of Lebanon and French colonization of Algeria.
Yeah, you know what is the meaning of that? Thank you for raising it. I think it's really important to think across these, you know, similarities. What emerges out of this is that this is one of the major principles of colonization, is to divide the communities and pit them one against the other. And these divisions, not only they do not make sense, even in the colonizers, you know, scientific with quotation mark, you know, procedures, it fails. It's unfounded. It has no ground because, as I mentioned earlier, for example, you know, when they started to separate the Berbers. So the majority of, you know, the population in North Africa are Berbers. They were Arabized, they were Judaized, they were Islamicized. But, you know, this is the local, the indigenous population. They were Berbers. But they started to distinguish the Berber as, you know, unique group and to tell all the rest, you are not Berbers, which really didn't stand, didn't hold. You know, when I'm thinking about the Zionist colonization of Palestine, just to think about how they chopped Palestinians into different communities. And it's not that there were no earlier, you know, differences, because, you know, food in Bethlehem, for example, differed slightly from food in Safed or from food in Nablus. But these differences were not differences that are justified by any means a struggle between those communities. And what Zionist colonization of Palestine did is when they started to expel Palestinians, so they created, you know, what is today seems so obvious, but, you know, it was fabricated in 48, which is the Gaza Strip. Gaza was never a strip. And Gaza became a strip because, you know, it was enclosed as a ghetto from the very beginning, from 48. So they created, you know, Palestinians in Gaza. But again, as I mentioned, you know, earlier, Palestinian resistance, Palestinians in Gaza, they knew from the beginning from where they are, and they transmitted to their children the name of the villages or the towns from where they were coming. Because, you know, in the 8 refugee camps that they created, that were created in 48, in Gaza, Palestinians were organized according to their, you know, places of provenance. So they separated Palestinians in Gaza with certain, you know, identities and rights that was on the one hand crafted locally, but on the other hand was crafted by the colonial regime after 67 when Gaza was recolonized. And Palestinians in the West Bank and Palestinians in Jerusalem and Palestinians in refugee camps. So a colonizing machine works through these kind of subgroups that have different rights in the sense that they can make their coming together as a group to struggle struggle is made very difficult. And there are so many other examples. So it's not surprising that the same has been done, you know, in Lebanon. And this reproduces itself in a way that even the colonized are participating in it. And we see it, you know, in for example, you know, in the refugee camps, Palestinian refugee camps in Syria and in Lebanon, how, you know, these tensions created by the colonial project were reproduced by local communities.
I think it's directly related to that concept of nation states. That's one of the things that I always felt. I always say that the Nakba started in 1917 with Sykes-Picot and not in 1948, because I mean, if we go back to before the formation of, you know, the nation states through colonization, historically the Jews and Arabs, they coexisted peacefully in the Arab world. You used the term Muslim Jew in your book, which I think was the first time I come across it, and it's a beautiful term. I also recall one of the book I've read, Blood and Faith, The Purging of Muslim Spain. In the introduction of the book, they mentioned that most Jews left to Ottoman lands at that time because they knew that, you know, there was no clear, I think, as far back, and I understand this is a biased approach, but I think that concept that all people living in these lands are, for the most part, equal. There is no distinguishing between identities and ethnicities. And I think there's a, I mean, you have read, I've come across a lot of things that said that the Muslim world has actually saved Judaism, specifically from those that were migrating before the First World War from Europe to the Middle East. What do you feel is the impact of Islam on Judaism and its formation?
So I would like, you know, first of all, to say something about, you know, one thing that you mentioned in your question. I don't want to idealize the Jewish Muslim world and to say that they lived in peace. They lived also, you know, yes. They also had, you know, intrigues, battles, struggles.
That's why I said my biases.
Yeah, no, but, you know, because, you know, I think that we have to accept it. You know, communities live in certain tensions. And this was part of what was there, and they always negotiated the tensions. This is, for me, a more adequate way to describe it, rather than to say that they always lived in peace. There were also, you know, moments of violence here and there. But this moment of violence or this moment of tensions were never conceived as, okay, so now we have to totally separate ourselves and define ourselves as a separate groups that its destiny is to fight the other groups. And with the emergence of this notion of the nation state, it meant to create a nation, a homogeneous nation, which in itself is a machine of purification. Because nowhere in the world people live totally, you know, in their purity, in this kind of imagined purity. There were always, you know, movements and migrations and commercial relationship and trade relationship in many places in the world before colonialism. What happened with colonialism and with emergence of the nation state as ideal solution to those struggles was actually to implement a machine of purification, an ethnic cleansing machine with the power of the state. So with the nation state, what we see is the emergence of two very problematic tools or technologies or institutions, the nation and the state. And think about, again, the Jews spread all over the world, you know, in Asia, in Africa, in Americas, in Europe, in the Middle East. And all of a sudden, with the emergence of this nation, idea of the nation, they are being made one nation, which in itself is a project of ethnic cleansing because they had to be removed from all parts of the world in order to become one entity that later on deserved the state. So we have a double configurations of violence in this idea of the nation state. So this is one thing that I wanted to say. The second thing that I wanted to say after the living in peace. Then about the Jewish Muslim world. So the Jewish Muslim world, it doesn't mean, you know, it's not an attempt to separate Christian altogether. It is an attempt to think about, you know, the Jewish Muslim world as a world where Jewish communities and also Christian communities in those worlds in the North Africa and Middle East were protected under the Ummah. It is an attempt to say no to think about the Jewish Muslim world that way is an attempt to say no to what the West invented after World War II, which is the Judeo-Christian world. and when they invented the Judeo-Christian world actually to absolve Europe from its crimes against Jews, they assigned to the Jews that were amalgamated an enemy, Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. But the many of the Jews were themselves Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. So you see being reproduced this attempt, this, you know, imperial attempt to subdivide groups, but this division do not hold water because Jews were, from my maternal side, we were Palestinian Jews. We were not born Israeli. I was born Israeli because the state forced on me this identity that erases my other forms of belonging. But my mother was a Palestinian Jew. My grandparents were Palestinian Jews, and they lived for centuries under the Ottoman Empire. So they were part of, you know, the environment that was cultivated under the Ottoman Empire that was very plural. And again, without idealizing, there was a lot of violence also under the Ottoman Empire. So the Jewish Muslim world is, and inhabiting the Jewish Muslim world is also thinking about together, about what was done to the Jews through these processes of creating them as one people, as one nation, that deserve a state, what was done to Palestine, and how we have to conceive this on a global scale. Because when we see the investment of the West in the genocide in Palestine, we have to understand that this investment didn't start in October 2023. This investment started in the wake of World War II, when actually they imposed a new world order. And within this new world order, the Jews had to be dissociated from the Muslims. And if I see, you know, if I think about, you know, processes of decolonization, so first of all, Palestine should be free. No, first of all, the genocide should cease. Then Palestine should be free. And Palestine should be free means that Palestine should regain its potentiality to be a place of plurality. And this cannot happen without undoing the removal of the Jews from the Jewish Muslim world, because the integration of the Jews into what is called, what was invented as the Judeo-Christian tradition, means that the Jews are becoming more and more part of the West. And they are not part of the West. Some of them were, you know, lived in Europe, but many other of them did not live in Europe. And we are speaking about few decades. So I think that the reversal of this, imagining that the Jewish Muslim world can not only be a world that we inhabit virtually, but it's a world that can have, again, you know, manifestation in geographies, can help to actually dismantle the Zionist state and participate in the freedom of Palestine and the return of Palestine and the return of Palestinians.
Most of the activism that has been happening in the West since October, surprisingly, not surprisingly, but I think has been led by Jews. And I think this is like, for me, I felt it's redefining the attempt of the West to remove the question of Palestine and the colonization of Palestine from Jewishness. I felt this is like an attempt for the Jews to go back into the center of it, and refuse that distinguish, you know, that shift that colonization has attempted to establish.
Yeah, and you know, these processes take sometimes long time to be materialized. But I think that we were trained to think that all Jews were Zionist, but the Zionist movement was marginal in the life of Jews before the Holocaust. And it is after the Holocaust, after the extermination of 6 million Jews in Europe, that Europeans were invested in supporting this marginal group and mandating it not only to destroy Palestine, but mandating the Zionist movement to represent the Jews all over the world. And this was, just think about, you know, the trauma of the Jews post-World War II, you know, 6 millions of, what was amalgamated as one people were exterminated. It was, you know, a traumatic moment. And instead of living through this trauma and trying to understand the meaning of this trauma and trying to understand how can they rebuild their communities in Europe, the Europe actually used the Zionist project in order to force the remaining of the survivors in Europe to join the Zionist project and to migrate to the Zionist colony in Palestine. So what we had is actually traumatized people that were given an enemy, were given a state as a gift, with quotation mark, as if this is their liberation project. And it took a while, I think few decades, because this take few decades, because, you know, the second generation, the second and the third generation were brainwashed with histories that were not their histories about how good it is to have Israel after the Holocaust, how safe it is for the Jews all over the world to know that they have a state in Palestine. And I think that what we see, what we saw with the genocide, is the coming out of the closet of many anti-Zionist Jews and the propagation of anti-Zionism as Jewish tradition. Because this was our tradition for, you know, decades, since the beginning of the Zionist movement. But it was a tradition that was crushed. It was a tradition that was outlawed. The Zionists really, you know, they violently struggled against anti-Zionism in many places. They killed, you know, the movement, the Bund movement, for example, that was, you know, much bigger than the Zionist movement, that was anti-Zionist. Not only many of the members of the Bund were exterminated by the Nazi and by Europe, but the Zionist movement killed the movement. The Bund movement. But what we see with the genocide, facing the genocide and belonging to a people that was, you know, exterminated also, there is no doubt that many Jews are reclaiming their anti-Zionism heritage and actually are reformulating. And this is, I think, the, you know, the contribution of my book is to re-understanding what is our liberation project. And our liberation project is liberation from Europe, liberation from being colonized by Europe through the gift, this horrible gift with quotation mark, that was given to the Zionist, which is Palestine. Make it your own country as a liberation project. So I think that what you see now in the support and the growth of anti-Zionist Jewish movements is, first of all, unconditional support expressed toward Palestinians. And when I'm saying unconditional support, it's not only to stop the genocide. It's the understanding that Palestine should be free. So it's not about fixing the problem the way that the West speak about it. It's about undoing the genocidal regime. So I think that the anti-Zionist, you know, Jewish movements or expressions are speaking about stopping the genocide, freeing Palestine, decolonizing Palestine, decolonizing the Jews from decades of brutal Zionist movement that shaped our histories, falsified our histories, and erased our belongings to different worlds. And what about our belonging to the Jewish Muslim world? Where is it? And I think that this is not only a liberation project. This is a global responsibility to make it exist, because it serves the interest of the West to believe that all Jews are Zionist and all Jews are European and all Jews are represented by those that the West mandated to represent us, diverse Jews.
I had one more question, but before that, it's something that came to mind before. I want to ask it now. As an a Muslim Jew, as you said, or as an Arab Jew, being born in Israel, was there any you know, structures that you felt had preference for European Jews versus Arab Jews? I'm aware of the Ethiopian Jews and what went on with them, and as well, and the Yemenis. But as a North African or as an Arab Jew, Algerian Jew, Muslim Jew, was there that structures that by, you know, biases and systemic racism and all that in the societies?
Obviously they were, and they are based, you know, on the same, you know, imperial technologies of, first of all, erasing our history and making of all of us Jews who were expelled from Spain, you know, in the 15th century, Jews who came from North Africa or the Middle East, making of all of us, you know, Mizrahi, which is Oriental, which with quotation mark, which is a very problematic category because they amalgamated those Jews that I relate to them as Muslim Jews, and they amalgamated all Jews coming from Europe into Ashkenazi Jews, which is also an amalgamation, and created this kind of class and race tension between those two groups. So just to think about the fact that there is less than 1% of women coming from North Africa and the Middle East in the academia in Israel. Less than 1% gives you an idea how biased all these institutions. But it's not only in terms of statistics. I never felt a belonging to this place because everywhere where, you know, I could, you know, exercise my professions as a curator, as a scholar, as a researcher, as a teacher at the university, these were white institutions. These were white institutions in the sense of, you know, Ashkenazi institutions, Euro-Ashkenazi institutions, in which what I said is a very limited place. And what I said at very limited place because it actually threatened the foundations of this state. So, you know, I heard, you know, oftentimes when I was, you know, an adult, I'm not speaking even about discrimination when I was a child. Why, Azulai, it's the name of your husband, probably. Because, you know, I pass not, you know, like my father who had, you know, dark skin. I pass more like, you know, in these kind of cliches as a white woman. So, you know, this kind of insulting, we didn't know that you are also Mizrahi, because I looked okay, I looked civilized, right? So they said, okay, it's probably your husband. So, you know, this kind of, you know, insults and this impossibility to do, you know, the work in those institutions because they reproduce their inherited, you know, acceptance that they have to comply with the whiteness of the institution, because many of the people in the institutions are not necessarily white, but they don't revolt against it. So they're reproducing those institutions that, you know, the colonizing state created. So, yeah, it is very hard to be Palestinian in the Zionist colony in Palestine, but it's also hard to be differently, I'm not comparing. It was also hard to be a Muslim Jew or an Arab Jew or a Berber Jew because Zionism is anti-Jewish movement. It is a colonizing movement against Palestinians, but Zionism is against our diversity. Our diversity is not just, you know, a category. Our diversity means our different histories. We have different ways of, you know, creating, you know, writing the Bible, the Torah. We have different ways of fabricating the sacred clothing of the Bible. We have different mode of reciting the Bible. You know, when you listen to an Algerian Jew reciting the Bible, you would think that you are listening to Arabic, even though they are reading Hebrew text, because, you know, the way that they pronounce the Ayn and the Ra and the Ra and the Ja, all these are, you know, they shared it with, they share their the muscle of their mouth with Arab. So this kind of detachment is an amputation, and it's an amputation physically, historically, symbolically. And I think that its repair is part of what we understand when we say no one is free until everybody is free, when we say it about Palestine. But it means that, it means on a global scale that we have also to liberate the Jews from the imposition of Zionism as part of who we are. We were not Zionist before Zionism was imposed on us in the wake of World War II.
There's one thing that I wanted to, I always felt that the part of the West's support for the Zionist entity is because the Zionist entity now is part of the Western European colonial cultural heritage. And in that context, I always felt that the Jewish homeland in Israel, away from Europe, is a form of anti-Semitism in itself.
It is. It is. As I said, in the wake of World War II, you know, when the Nazi finished their job, the Jews stayed in Europe in displaced person camps from 45 to 48. Because Europe didn't do anything to rebuild Jewish communities in Europe. So the Zionist, you know, agents from the colony came every day to the camps in order to persuade these, you know, the survivors of the Holocaust, come to Palestine. And when they went to Palestine, they were actually expelled from the Haifa port to Cyprus because they, under the British mandate, they were not allowed to enter. So there is such a big cynicism in those Zionist agents, actors, that they took, you know, survivors of the Holocaust, which was, I don't even have to say how traumatic it is. They convinced them, come to fight a war that was not theirs against Palestinians. And they knew that when those Jews will decide to go to Palestine, they will be expelled again to camps in Cyprus under the British mandate. So yes, Zionism and Zionism that colonized Palestine was from the get-go against the Jews.
What do you think is needed to move toward a just future that acknowledges both Jewish suffering in Europe and the Palestinian dispossession and Nakba and genocide that's currently happening?
We have to dismantle the technologies that, you know, exterminated the Jews, like many other groups. The Jews were not the only group that was targeted by Europe.
Yes.
We have to recall this. So we have to dismantle, we have to aspire to decolonize, to dismantle those technologies. And when I'm speaking about technologies, for me, the border patrol is a technology. The museum is a technology. The archive is a technology. The AI is a technology. All those technologies that were shaped in order to eternalize expropriation, to eternalize the right of the West and its sucursals actually to exercise genocidal violence. So I think that, as I said, the genocide should stop, you know, should have stopped already, you know, when it started. But the genocide should stop. And the colonization of Palestine is interdependent with the decolonization of the Jews, which means the dismantling of all these European technologies that support the perpetuation of genocidal regimes. So I see, in this sense, I said earlier, no one is free until everybody is free. And I think that it is urgent to dismantle those technologies that separate us from each other and through soft technologies also, which gives us or assign to us histories that are not ours. And our history, for example, my history, our history, those who lived centuries in the Jewish Muslim world, our histories are there. It doesn't mean necessarily geographically to return there, but these are our histories that we have to reclaim in order to undo this monstrous invention, which they call the Judeo-Christian tradition, in the name of which they persecute all those who are opposing today to the genocide in Gaza.
Thank you for tuning into the Palestine Debrief podcast, a production of CJPME and a proud member of the Harbinger Media Network. I hope you have enjoyed this episode. I'm your host, Wissam Sheikh Hassan. See you next time.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We end today's show in Gaza, where relentless winter rainstorms have flooded thousands of tents of forcibly displaced Palestinians.
Due to the rain yesterday, water gathered over the worn-out tents and broke the wood. And water went down on those asleep, and we got up at 3 a.m. to try to gather what is left of the tent. This is our situation.
This comes as at least six infants and one adult living in displaced camps in Gaza have died from the cold as winter temperatures drop. Meanwhile, a United Nations report published today finds that Israeli strikes on and near hospitals in the Gaza Strip have, quote, pushed the healthcare system to the brink of total collapse, with catastrophic effect on Palestinians' access to health and medical care. The world is still calling on Israel to release Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, director of Kamal Adwan Hospital in Gaza's Jabalia refugee camp, after he was detained in a raid on the hospital by Israeli forces and reportedly taken to a detention camp with his leg badly injured. For more, we're joined by two doctors who worked in Gaza this year. In Amman, Jordan, Dr. Mimi Saeed is an emergency medicine physician. She just left Gaza for the second time this year. She volunteered for 4 weeks at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunus and Al-Aqsa Hospital in Deir al-Balah. Also with us is her colleague, Dr. Firoz Sidva, a trauma surgeon who volunteered at the European Hospital in Khan Yunus in the early spring. His piece last month for Foreign Policy is headlined, "The U.S. Must Support Gaza Before Winter, Seasonal Rains and Flooding Portend Further Humanitarian Catastrophe." We welcome you both to Democracy Now. Dr. Mimi Sayed, if you could begin, you were just there in Gaza. Describe where you were and the conditions that you've seen in the hospitals that remain where you worked.
Hi, thank you for having me. Yes, I actually just got back yesterday. So, the conditions are terrible. They were terrible in August, but winter has kind of brought in a new level of destruction. The children that I saw just disproportionately affected by this, the malnourishment, the contamination of the water, everything is just tenfold now because of the dropping temperatures. There's the same type of airstrikes and the missiles and the targeting of children that I witnessed again. We saw the same type of shrapnel injuries, traumatic amputations, blunt trauma, and then open skull wounds of children. Just the same type of brutal aggression.
And while you were in Gaza, you gave an interview to Sky News, Dr. Saeed, and you said while in Gaza, you said, quote, "Humanity is ending here." That's what you see, humanity ending here in Gaza. If you could elaborate further on, in particular, this issue of water, why it is that so much of the water supply is contaminated, and what this means for people in Gaza, in hospitals, and in particular, the most vulnerable, children, infants, and the elderly.
Yeah, I mean, I had an opportunity this time to actually walk around in the camps and talk to the families and actually visit inside of the tents, just deep inside those encampments. And the living conditions are just deplorable. I mean, they are not compatible with human life. The contamination of the water is very high. I spoke to the infection control manager there that takes care of the water filtration system. And he was explaining to me that the filtration, the chlorine, the solvents that they need, the membranes that they need, none of that is available. The water is coming up, I mean, literally from a hose. Children fill like these dirty plastic containers, and it's supposed to be filtered again, but those filters that are in front of residential areas, the power is generated by fuel, which of course is not available. So they end up drinking this water that's actually just meant for like washing and such, but that's leading to this chronic diarrhea that children have, especially small babies that are affected so much by this. Every child there that I saw in the emergency department had diarrhea. And then it leads with the malnourishment on top of that, it's leading to organ failure, things like kidney failure we'd see in children. I mean, it's rates that you don't typically see in other countries. It's all because of this water, very high in salt content. You can't filter that out. It's seawater. Of course, the elderly are at the same risk of becoming ill, critically ill that way.
And Dr. Firoz Sidva, if you could talk about, you've made remarks to the effect that hundreds of thousands of toddlers and elderly could potentially die in Gaza in February or by February, and respond specifically to the raid on Kamal Adwan Hospital, the last remaining functional major hospital in northern Gaza, and what the effects of that will be, and the fact that, of course, its director, Dr. Hussam Abu Safia, has been detained, his leg badly injured.
As far as we know, Dr. Abu Safia has been detained. Don't know where he is. Don't know what's being done to him. May never find out. Who knows? Kamal Adwan's been destroyed. It had barely been a functional hospital in any sense for months. It's been under siege for at least a month. The Israelis, there was one point at which it really just got incredibly sadistic. The Israelis allowed the only delivery of supplies during this time, and then tank shelled the little warehouse that it was put into in the hospital. It's just, it's pretty sadistic at this point. And the U.S. goes along with it. So we can't really blame the Israelis for it. We're the ones allowing it to happen. But the, but in terms of the public health situation in Gaza, I think it's exactly like Dr. Syed just described. And it's what Dr. Parkinson and I wrote about in Foreign Policy, like you mentioned. You know, Gaza is a half child population. The entire, you know, 90% of the population is homeless, meaning their homes have been physically destroyed or they've just been displaced from them. But regardless, they live in temporary shelters. As you heard from the, or as the listeners heard from the, at the beginning of the program, when it rains, these shelters don't provide any protection from the rain and the flooding that happens every year in Gaza. And so now the temperature is quite chilly. Well, the adults can survive a 50-degree winter, but even adults, not if they're wet constantly. I mean, you're talking about being wet for 3 months straight. And furthermore, they're not just wet, they're living in a land that literally doesn't have a sewage system anymore. It's one of the most crowded places in the world. The Mwasi, where most of these people are, the 1.8 million people that are concentrated there, are living in a place that literally has no sewage system. 1.8 million people are living in a place that has 121 toilets. This is just outrageous. And then on top of that, the Israelis aren't even allowing soap to be brought into Gaza. So it's not hard to figure out what's going to happen when all of that is put together. It's very likely that tens or even hundreds of thousands of people are going to die of the combination of malnutrition, displacement, exposure to the elements, and hypothermia this winter. And at this point, there isn't actually anything that can be done about it.
And Dr. Sidhwa, if you could comment also, I mean, given the many, many reasons that people are dying prematurely in Gaza, hypothermia, hunger, etc., what do you think of this, the count that's always given, 45,000 people have been killed in Gaza since the war began in October 2023. What do you think the actual count might be, given all of these reasons?
It's very hard to make accurate estimates. You know, Alex DeWall just wrote a good blog post at the Tufts Peace Center that he runs. He's the leading historian of famine in the modern period. And he writes what he wrote, that it's extremely unlikely that fewer than 10,000 people have died. And he was hesitant to make any more from what are called indirect causes of war. And he was hesitant to make more predictions than that. But the if you look at the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification data, it's hard. You can't estimate that less than 60,000 people have died of starvation in Gaza. And that's the only data that's really available. There's nothing else. There actually was just a study published in a nutrition science journal. It just came across my desk yesterday. And I've requested it from our library, so I haven't been able to read it yet, so I don't know what it says. But the abstract was terrifying, saying that basically the entire population has lost weight, which, you know, Mimi and I have, having been there, we can definitely attest to that. But it's very likely that tens of thousands of people have starved to death in Gaza, many of them small children. But what's more important than the number is that we don't know. We're doing this to an entire population of child refugees, and we don't even know if we're starving tens of thousands of children to death. That's crazy. What kind of behavior is that?
Well, Dr. Mimi Syed, let me get your response to that. In other words, you know, what the U.S. has been doing in all this time, they could have easily, as many have pointed out, pushed and made a ceasefire happen. That has not occurred. And now we have Trump coming in 3 weeks. He said if the hostages are not released by Inauguration Day, January 20th, all hell is going to break out. What do you imagine might happen then?
Oh, I mean, it needs to stop is the number one point. But there is absolutely no dignity left. And that's what I mean when I say humanity has ended. Feroz is talking about malnourishment. Absolutely. Every single child has some sort of hypopigmentation. And, you know, you and I both know as physicians, that's the number one sign of acute malnourishment. Children are displaying these signs all the time. And then when we talk about dignity, imagine, you know, this population was not poor to begin with. The majority of people were well-to-do. They had professions like you and I do. They had education, 98% literacy rate there. overnight, their lives were changed. You imagine living in a tent that's made out of scraps in cold weather with about 20 other people. You know, on so many levels, that's a violation of a person's dignity and basic human needs.
That's it for this hour. On today's show, we focused on a new book by Dr. Ariella Azoulay, who is a renowned scholar and author. Dr. Azoulay argues in her new book that there is a need to end the European colonization of the Jewish people. She argues that the West hijacked Jewish identity to absolve Europe from its horrendous crimes against the Jewish community and subsequently to serve Western interests in West Asia. Then we focus on the current situation in Gaza and saw how the start of winter is worsening even more the impacts of the ongoing genocide against Palestinians. If you missed parts of the show, you can go to Security's website at security.ca and listen to it again. All the episodes are archived on our page. Just click on the name of the show and you will find it. You will also find the link to the archive on CFRC's website at cfrc.ca. You are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
The Corridor is an award-winning news program hosted by Dinah Jansen and Jesse Bell, airing every Thursday at 5 p.m. on CFRC 101.9 FM. With contributions from local Journalism Initiative reporters ranging from Morrisburg to Coburg, The Corridor is your premier destination for truly local news that matters to you. The Corridor is also available as a podcast on all major podcast streaming platforms.
Cold weather getting you down? Warm up this season with amazing hot food to go at Old Farm Fine Foods. Pizza, frittata, sausage rolls, sandwiches, soups, and more are ready and waiting to get in your belly. Plus, you can also buy fresh and frozen foods to prepare at home and enjoy a huge selection of meats, cheeses, produce, coffee, beverages, and condiments. Pop into the shop Monday through Saturday between 8 and 5 at 204 Berry Street in downtown Kingston. And don't forget to follow Old Farm Fine Foods on Instagram at OldFarmFF to get the scoop on the latest goodies. Old Farm Fine Foods, comfort food you can count on.
What's up with Charles? You can't handle me.
Handle. Mm.
Hold up. Ain't you Nathaniel B?
What is that?
Get the
Tune in at Wednesdays at 2 p.m. for the program. I, your host Nate, will go over a variety of different genres and themes. I sometimes call my friends and do dumb stuff, and if you guys like dumb stuff, you're gonna love my show. So yeah, Wednesdays, 2. Be there.
You're listening to Kingston's only campus community radio station, broadcasting 24/7, 365 on 101.9 FM and CFRC.ca. Tune in for the best local programming.
And when I listen to a really good song, I start nodding my head like I'm saying, yes!